All right, hey everybody, welcome to This Anthro Life. As always, this is Adam Gamwell.
And I'm Matt Arts.
And today we are talking about a subject that's near and dear to both Matt and I's hearts, and that's design anthropology. You know, we both kind of work in design anthropology, and we're super excited because we're talking with one of the preeminent design anthropologists in the world today, Dr. Elizabeth Ardori Tunstall. She's a design anthropologist and a public intellectual, design advocate, does so much cool stuff, and she is currently the Dean of Design at Ontario College of Art and Design in Toronto. And she's also the first Black and first Black female dean of a faculty of design anywhere. So it's super awesome and an honor to get to speak with her today. And as we talk so much about, you know, how design functions for humans and what we're doing with it. She works in a bunch of great programs, such as the Cultures-Based Innovation Initiative. She's worked for Design for Democracy. She's worked across the world in Chicago and Australia. And, you know, so we're honored to have her with us today, and we can't wait to share.
Yeah, it was a really great conversation, especially, you know, for anybody working in the field or for those looking to go into the field, to hear about how Dori came into design anthropology, her evolving approach, how she's teaching the next generation, and to sort of dive into topics like why the IRS may not be so bad, or how keeping the sacred and profane in mind may help avoid misappropriation, and how, you know, our value systems get expressed in design and what that might mean for future technologies like AI. It was really great. You gotta stay tuned.
And so as always, I want to let you know that we are brought to you in collaboration with the American Anthropological Association, and they have their annual meeting coming up in November. So we definitely want to recommend checking that out. Your registration is open now at americananthro.org. You can go to the website. We'll put it in the show notes. Just to, you know, to shout out for that. It's been an incredible... It's an incredible conference. It's a lot of fun. It's a whirlwind, 4 to 5 days, depending on how long you go. TAL has been there before. We're going to be there again in force this year, pushing the podcast, where we'll be talking on panels about podcasting. We'll let you know what some of those are as we get closer to the date. And so we are super excited. Again, registration is open now, and it is highly worth it. It'll be in Washington, D.C., which is always a fun trip. Anyway, and we're also brought to you in collaboration with our friends at the Society for Applied Anthropology, because, again, this TAL and podcasting itself and anthropology is about applying our research and our work and showing, giving you kind of insights and ideas of how we can apply this thinking. That's what today's episode is really about, as well as our good friends over at Sapiens. This is a new science anthropology journal, kind of online magazine that is an amazing set of articles and content they put out that gives us new ways of thinking about the world, what it means to be human. You can think about it like Nat Geo or Scientific American. It's awesome stuff. So without further ado, we'll dive into the conversation. You've written about these sort of five iterations of design anthropology itself, and I'd be really curious to hear, because I know it kind of links into your own story about how you got into it, and then you know, where that brings us today.
Yeah. Well, the five iterations of design anthropology, and I'll kind of just label them first and then probably break them down. The first is the yin and yang of design anthropology. The second iteration is Kwame, which is questions, assumptions, methods, and evidence. The third iteration is values, design, experience. As a sort of methodology of design anthropology. The fourth iteration is the seven principles of design anthropology, and then the fifth iteration is what I'm working on now at OCAD called Respectful Design.
Okay, cool.
and that pretty much lays out, like, those are the sort of the chapter titles of my entire career over the past 15 plus years, where the yin and yang of design anthropology kind of started just when I got out of grad school. So I went to my PhDs in anthropology from Stanford University. Although I was a very strange anthropologist, because, and this is before I knew what design was, but each chapter of my PhD thesis had a different layout, look, and feel based on the vernacular sort of design cultures of Ethiopia, which is where I did my field work. So I was already, always took art classes, even up until probably graduate school. So I was always interested in the relationship between form and content. And oftentimes in university, I would, you have to do a weekly response to some reading. I would do a drawing or a comic strip. I would get extra credit for the drawings I would do on the margins of my paper. So I was always interested in visual expression as much as I was interested in sort of words and content and text and meaning. So the first iteration of design anthropology in terms of the yin-yang was I was taking, this is around 1999, 2000, 2001. I was taking a lot of Tai Chi. And they talk about, again, from Taoism, this idea of yin and yang energy, yin energy being more internal, it's about cellular self-reflection, yang energy about sort of activism and change, being sort of very pushing out upon the world. And I thought it was an apt metaphor to define the relationship between design and anthropology, where, again, the sort of stereotypes of anthropology is, you know, a person sitting back reflecting on the status of the universe. Again, in anthropology, there's like the sort of prime directive in terms of not engaging with cultures to be able to sort of change things. Whereas design has that opposite ethos where it's like, let's go out and make stuff happen. And what's our intervention and how are we being sort of disruptive? So for me, it was a good way to talk about the balance and harmony that's needed between sort of reflection that you get from anthropology and sort of making change that you get from design that would help a lot of us who kind of, again, sort of design anthropology. We were probably like the third generation of design anthropologists, the first generation being kind of the Xerox Park people, the second generation being people like Ken Anderson at Intel. And so being the third generation of design anthropologists working in places like Sapient and ARC Worldwide, we were trying to figure out kind of who we were in terms of like the use of ethnography in sort of design processes, but also what it meant to work with designers who were building up those ethnographic skills. And so design anthropology became a way to talk about that interrelationship between reflection and action, that I could explain to people what it is that I actually do.
Fair point, because I think that's maybe the most common question if you do an anthropology degree, right?
And so, and it's even a thing where, like, you know, everyone's like, what's your definition of design anthropology? And I always have two, like, depending on whether you're coming from, like, the more reflective yin side or more the action-oriented yang side, where it's either, you know, how the processes and artifacts of design help define what it means to be human, which is more of the self-reflective yin version, or I talk about it is... how design translates values into tangible experiences. And that's kind of like the yang version of the sort of action version. And so depending on who am I talking to, I'll either use one or two of those definitions of design anthropology. But again, it reflects that yin-yang sort of dynamic between, again, reflection and action.
The translating of values I find very interesting because, you know, it sort of raises for me the question of whose values and you know, and is it the project sponsor? Is it who you're designing for in the end? And, you know, working in digital, remedying those is often difficult. Obviously, the project sponsor wants it to really be to serve them in many ways. So how do you handle that?
Yeah, and I think that's so like the third iteration of design anthropology in terms of sort of values, design, experience really is actually the breaking down of that statement, sort of design translates values into tangible experiences, to break that down into a methodology that actually allows you to explore the kind of questions that you're asking, right? So it's like, okay, we start with values, whose values? Which values, like, again, you'll have a whole range of values that are available because we're that complex as humans or complex as a company or organization. The values design experience kind of methodology really came to the fore of the work I was doing with Design for Democracy because the big question we were trying to figure out there is what is this value democracy? What does it actually mean to people? How is it that design then makes that value of democracy tangible to people through ballots or the way you organize your polling place or the way in which you interact with the court of law, and the design of that sort of makes you feel like you can engage or not engage, or the way in which you design a post office to make people feel like, are you a citizen, are you a customer, are you a criminal? Right. So in that way, sort of the values design experience as a methodology of design, as the methodology of design anthropology, kind of allows you to look at, again, specific values and where they come from, how they're sort of being translated in design, go out and evaluate the actual experiences they build for people or create for people or set up for people. Then again, I think in a sort of, you know, redesign process, go back and figure out, again, if there's an alignment between those experiences and the way the design's translating them. Although for me, what I think is really important from a design anthropologist perspective is actually going back out and evaluating, again, the values itself in the way that you've sort of expressed, like, you know, whose values are we actually prioritizing over other people's values. Like with the work with Design for Democracy, I also did a lot of work with the IRS, the Internal Revenue Services, with John Jacobin and their design publications team, which, again, he was pushing through an initiative around design management. And, you know, again, one of the things that we had lots of conversations about is, again, what are the values of the IRS? And the IRS actually has, like, articulated, like, their values as part of their kind of professionalization processes, particularly in the 1990s. But actually what became really important in that reevaluation is actually what makes the IRS important is that it's the common good, right? Like, it's the common good. It's the pool of resources that we gather from everyone so that we can, through the process of appropriations, through the Senate, when they are operating at their most optimized and generous, it's the way in which we define what is it that needs to be common amongst all citizens to be able to provide what it is that we can't provide for ourselves individually, right? And so to talk about the IRS not as the person who's going to be tracking you down to make sure that you pay your taxes, but to talk about the IRS as the common good, that, again, issues of appropriation is issues of another institution, another that's the legislature, but in terms of, again, an executive department, the only place that we have in our government that is really focused on how do we create the resources for everyone is actually the IRS. And so that's a kind of process of going about and thinking about what are alternative values that we can emphasize and communicate to people about, in this case with the IRS, a very fundamental institution.
Hmm. That is a fascinating example. It's funny because colloquially, right, the IRS is rarely the good guy.
Yeah.
In this
yeah.
case, perhaps we need to turn our thinking on our head. I have a question to think about that idea. I was reminded of when you were talking about the idea of actually bringing the values back is something we need to reiterate and think with. If I ask a question on the more anthropological side of this, is that in terms of the role of anthropological theory, because I know in a lot of, like, design anthropology literature, like Wendy Gunn stuff, and George Marcus writes about this too, is that, like, he actually talks about anthropological theory itself and theorizing about human being as prototypes that we go test out in the real world. And I don't know if this applies at all, but it's a curious thought to me in terms of, is there a role of using sort of theoretical ideas, or is this more of like we go out and test what's in the world? And maybe this might be specific to this iteration of design anthropology. I'm not sure, you know, or is there a notion that does anthro theory play a role or not? I mean, I struggle with this myself as an anthropologist because I don't, you know.
And again, maybe it goes back to sort of the yin yang thing. Like the production of theory is that part of self-reflection, but then you only know if a theory works if you put it into action in the real world. And then if it doesn't work, you refine your theory. And at the same time, again, as you, again, tying it to sort of values, design, experiences, again, if you find in your theorization that there needs to be another theory, right, another set of values that are articulated through this theory, then you have to do the work to figure out what that is, but then you have to put it back out into the world again. And this is how knowledge grows, but it is also how our practices grow, that we grow as a society, as we grow as a set of human beings, right? So I think I've always been fond of the word praxis, because my work is always about the integration and the constant iteration of both, right? The iteration of my theory leads to the iteration of my practice. And that's my career. Like, why there's five iterations of design anthropology, right? Is that the context of application shapes the way in which I need to explain what it is. So, for example, moving from yin-yang of design anthropology as a first iteration, the second iteration came out of the fact, like, I began to teach at University of Illinois at Chicago in the School of Design there. And the students were like, this is great, but I don't know what I'm supposed to do with this. Like, this is way too abstract. Can you break it down for me? And so the second iteration, so design anthropology as relates to questions, assumptions, methods, and evidence, actually comes from anthropological theory. So this ideal, Alan Bernard, who is an American anthropologist in this book called The History, History of Anthropology, History and Theory of Anthropology, he talks about theory being made up of a set of questions, assumptions, methods, and evidence. And again, he like introduces that on one page and it goes through, and he doesn't talk more about it in the book, even though it's an underlying sort of theoretical framework for his book. But I took that and I sort of operationalized it for my students, because then I could talk about from an interdisciplinary perspective, okay, what is the question of anthropology versus the question of design versus the question of design research versus the question of design thinking versus the question of whatever, or from like, what is the main question of engineering versus the main question of marketing versus the main question of politics? What assumptions do they make about the world? What methods do they use to do it? Like, debates around qualitative versus quantitative is about, again, the question of methodology as it relates to a set of assumptions that you have. And then what evidence is convincing to whomever your audience is and what you're trying to communicate. And so the question of design anthropology is, again, is that thing of how does the processes and artifacts of design help define what it means to be human? Its assumptions are a combination, a hybridization of some of the assumptions of anthropology around, again, the anthropologist and participant observation as the sort of medium of knowledge in and of itself. That then ties into notions of design as sort of designer, as facilitator. The impact is generally most of the time in terms of the assumption that it's very sort of local and qualitative. It's about why and how a small group of people do things. And, you know, again, its methods are things like, you know, in context interviews, because you need to be there in some particular way, or visual diaries or visual journals where if you can't be there, get them to document enough so like you can see what's going on as if you're there with them. You know, and the evidence are these are beautiful hybrid things that came out of like, you know, the work that was done at eLab, which is, you know, my first job was at eLab, which became Sapient, and things like the experience model, where you take all this great ethnographic data, but use the tools of design and particularly graphic design to communicate them in a way that prioritizes, again, what are the values that are most salient to solving the client or community or organizational problem. Like, all of these kind of forms are really is about understanding the differences in questions, assumptions, methods, and evidence. And I only got to that by the iteration that was required by my students to really understand design anthropology in a way that they could use it. And so my students for the last 15 years plus have been using questions, assumptions, methods, and evidence, Kwame, to figure out their PhD thesis, to do their research, to do comparisons between sort of different disciplines, or do comparisons between what is the question that the client is asking versus what is the question that the community or market is asking. So it's a tool that they've been using quite effectively to, again, compare, but also figure out what it is in their heads that they need to communicate to a group of people who are not in their heads effectively.
So building on that, I have a question related to the design as a facilitator. So, you know, of course, if you go into industry, you, if you're in one of these roles, you'll be carrying out research. But there also seems to be a big opportunity to really play the facilitator role amongst these very multidiscipline teams. And maybe, you know, I'm not sure if Sapient would have provided this, but I assume as the corporation grows in size and the teams become larger with different skill sets and different worldviews, the ability to act as a facilitator may increase versus, you know, a small team in a startup. So if you've experienced that, how would you say that you were able to really take on that role as the facilitator between the different individuals within the team? You know, was that something that it was recognized maybe in Sapient, you know, as a skill of anthropology?
Yeah, because, I mean, again, it's a shared skill, but it expresses itself in different ways. Like, think about, again, what's the training of an anthropologist, right? Is to be able to communicate across differences, really. I mean, if you break it down at its most fundamental level, it's really to understand and be able to communicate across differences. So in essence, what an anthropologist does is facilitate, right? To help identify what are the commonalities and what are the differences in people's perspectives in order to achieve something, which is probably most of the time understanding. And then once you have understanding, then you can move into all other forms of actions. Now, the designer shares in some ways, again, that same sort of thing, because most of the time what a designer is doing is trying to figure out around the variety of people's needs, what is the form that you can give this different expressions of what is necessary, right? What form can you give it that actually will help bring people together, to help bring people in dialogue around what it is that they actually really want and need to go forward with together? But again, so this is why, like, again, from a yin and yang perspective, the combination of anthropology and design is like superpowers, right? Like, it, everyone enhances their superpowers by being able to, let's say, in this facilitation role, see that facilitation role not just in terms of like bridging those differences, which we talk about a lot in anthropology, but also, again, using tangible form as a way to really make sure or facilitate the conversations that allow us to bridge those differences, right?
Mm-hmm. So since you're a mentor training young minds, you know, if you were recommending industry positions, what might you recommend individuals look at, considering that you're not going to find the job that says anthropologist in the title, right? So, you know,
but you do like more and more. So he's like, you know, first recommendation, join the Anthro Design Listserv, because it is the one place where, like, you I feel old, right? So, like, when I had my first job position, which was, again, the job title was, you know, experience modeler. It would be very rare that you would find a job that would ask for anthropologists in the background. Now, if you look at a job around sort of user experience strategists, brand strategists, user experience designer, anywhere around, like in some fields, more about sort of customer service specialist. There are so many different roles now in which, again, you may not have the title looking for a design anthropologist, but actually anthropology is one of the backgrounds that they look at and they accept as being able to provide them with the kind of competencies that they're looking for. And I think particularly sort of anything that now that it requires a strategic role, so again, strategic researcher, strategic designer, brand strategists, that all of these roles that really require strategy, anthropology is seen as a set of skills that lends itself to those kind of tasks, which is really mostly strategy is about, again, understanding the variety of perspectives there, helping to prioritize. Again, a lot of strategy is about how do you prioritize amongst different stakeholders what steps you need to do first versus second versus third. Like, what's the process that you achieve all the things that as a community they want to achieve, right? And anthropology really provides those skills.
That's super interesting, yeah. So let's jump in. So we have the third. I think that was a deep dive into the second iteration. That was awesome. I love the thinking too, and just with Alan Bernard too, and the idea of this sort of like very simple questions, assumptions, methods, and evidence. You know, four. You know, obviously there are four deep topics themselves, but it's an incredibly to me wonderful lucid way of just saying here's like four ways we do anthropological thinking. That's actually beautiful. It's funny, you know, because on some level, you know, we wonder, because as we've kind of been talking about too, there's this other piece that, you know, traditional anthropology is much more sort of uncomfortable. Or as I think you wonderfully said, the prime directive is to sort of not interact or not to impact, I suppose. And, you know, that so much of that idea is changing because that's impossible in the first place, right? Malinowski didn't just magically go out into the field and then not impact people. But then, like, there is really this sort of embracing of that. I think it's great. And even these four, you know, simple ideas, because you're right, like a lot of anthropological work itself seems to be based around how do we, it's at this core, of to communicate across differences, right? And how do we translate ideas? But I like actually, even the notes I'm taking, like we point out the idea that we kind of function as facilitators or anthropologists do, but in the parentheses is often to achieve something, but that part can be left out if you don't acknowledge it. And that's, it's crucial. I like that what design anthro does is just say that's actually, that part of the sentence matters a lot too.
Yeah. Agreed. So again, I talked about values design experience a lot in terms of, again, the work with the IRS. And so I think I'll move to the sort of fourth iteration, which is the seven principles of design anthropology. And I won't go through all of them because I think, because in that will be a really long conversation. But I'll sort of talk about them at a high level in terms of what it really means and the shift, right, the iteration that happens. So at a values design experience, I left the United States and I moved to Australia. I moved to Melbourne, Australia to work at Swinburne University as associate professor in design anthropology. So I actually had a job title that said design anthropology. And with the explicit agenda to build a design anthropology program. So when I was at University of Illinois at Chicago, there was the intention to do that. And I had actually created a lot of courses to sort of build that, but I actually didn't have the mandate to freely build a master's program in design anthropology until I got to Swinburne University. But being in the context of Australia and being particularly, I think, in the context of the struggle for sovereignty and self-determination among the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities there, being sort of linked into those communities, that all of a sudden parts of sort of, like, again, what's the values of design anthropology within that context? And in 2011, there was a group of international designers, anthropologists, indigenous activists, and scholars who got together in Bellagio, Italy, to spend a week figuring out kind of what design anthropology is, particularly as it relates to cultures-based innovation. So how do we drive innovation processes from this perspective of deep culture? Out of that conversation, there was a question that was posed to me, which is, how does design anthropology contribute to these processes of decolonization, right? Because, again, part the reason why we have the prime directive in anthropology was because anthropology was actually quite active in the colonial project, right? And so that response of the prime directive is like, oh, let's just move away from that, right? And so I was called to sort of account for how design anthropology fits into what have been in the past colonial projects of anthropology and how it's a break from that, how it's different from that. Because again, particularly with dealing with indigenous communities, there's a lot of antagonism, well-deserved antagonism towards anthropology as a discipline. In fact, at the conference, one of my like dearest friends, Herman Piakea Clark, who's a native Hawaiian designer, he said to me like, Dore, I love you, but I hate anthropology. And so the seven principles of design anthropology comes out of, again, the next iteration, me needing to articulate how design anthropology fits within these processes of decolonization. Drawing again from the early work of Faye Harrison in terms of sort of decolonizing anthropology in and of itself, but tying that into indigenous perspectives around decolonization. And this is Linda Towai Smith, decolonizing methodologies. So really linking into that. So the general overview of the seven principles is, again, another iteration of values design experiences. So it asks these moral questions around how are you approaching values? How are you approaching values in a way that respects the fact that, I guess, one of the major theoretical underpinnings is this notion of transculturation, which is classic anthropological theory by Fernando Ortiz, a Cuban anthropologist who was writing in the 1940s and 50s, a student of Boas. So classic anthropological theory, transculturation, which really says that in the encountering of cultures, there are three processes that take place. There's a process of sort of acculturation where you take parts of this of other cultures, right? There's a process of deculturation in which culture is lost, and most of the time that is lost under conditions of coercion. And then there's neoculturation where these new kind of hybrid cultures come out that aren't related to any of the parent cultures. So when we understand values from a decolonizing perspective in anthropology, it's really tied up into this notion of transculturation where it's like, you actually have to pay attention to what is gained, what is lost, what is created new, and the power relationships that exist within that, right? You can't ignore that the taking of culture, that there are some cultures that are more privileged into sort of borrowing from other cultures. This is why we have all these issues of appropriation and misappropriation, particularly in design. You can't ignore the fact that, again, each generation has to go through the process of deciding what aspects of cultures that they want to sort of take, borrow, keep for themselves or create new. And so you have to actually understand culture making is as this really dynamic process. And that's really, then it's like, if you're going to understand values, you really have to understand all of those specific kinds of processes. When you're doing design, when you're translating those values into design, there's a certain ethics around kind of, again, drawing from Scandinavian cooperative and participatory design, that you need to sort of make sure that you're engaging and respecting people's knowledge within that. And in terms of the experiences aspect of it, is that the goal of a design anthropology engagement is to create conditions of compassion among human beings and to sort of conditions of harmony as it relates to the natural world and all of the things that are within it, which humans are part of, but have not established harmonious relationships with. And so at the sort of high level, that's what it's sort of taking values, design, and experience, but articulating that within the project of decolonization and the role that design anthropologists or anthro-designers from the other sort of direction, the role that they have to play from a moral and ethical perspective in facilitating these processes of articulation of values, this process of design, this process of actually creating, you know, the end goal of creating harmonious and compassionate experiences for everything in the universe.
Related to that, in the concept of appropriation, something I've often raised as a question to others is sort of around when is something appropriated? And you know, obviously, if it's done today, we often, and if, of course, if it's creating a sort of a, you know, harm through, in, you know, disproportionate power structures, we obviously discuss it in a relatively negative light. But we all kind of take for granted that we engage in stuff today that at one time was appropriated, but it seems that it happened so long ago that now we're almost okay with it. So, for example, like a lot of Cuban music, right? It's African rhythm, it's flamenco guitar from Spain. Today we love it. We don't really think much of it. But often if an artist today creates music where they're, you know, pulling from other cultures, and especially if it's being mass produced, it oftentimes might be deemed, you know, cause for concern. So how, you know, obviously going forward in design, we need to be aware of this, but how do you sort of remedy that sort of dilemma that, you know, and you mentioned food culture, you know, food culture is a great example of it.
Well, I mean, again, actually, I had a really good conversation about this with students that I taught in India. So kind of combination of design. We had a workshop on design anthropology sponsored by the Vinogren grant to do a 1 month intensive on design anthropology with a group of anthropology and design students from all over India at a master's level. And we actually had a really long conversation about that. And so they actually articulated something that I hadn't figured out, but is absolutely brilliant, which is the issues of sort of in terms of like moving from appropriation to misappropriation, that the it has to do with the movement from what a culture sort of considers to be profane, so to speak, versus the sacred. Right. And so the issues come when you borrow something that's within the categories of the sacred, because, and it really has to do with, again, our notions of the sacred means that the motif or the sound or the music or the pattern or the dance or the dress or whatever is actually about communing with the higher powers and higher powers that actually govern the movement of the universe. And so when you borrow something from the sacred and you use it in a negative way, you actually can create disharmony or potentially sort of destroy the balance of the universe. And so it all has to do with, but there are things that, let's say, with food culture, like, again, if it's not within the realm of the sacred, that anything in which you can learn gradually and develop deeper knowledge of, right? Those are things that can be shared, because those are things that within, let's say, the internal culture itself, they are also on a journey and process of learning and sharing, right? It's just becomes an issue when you're somehow trampling on the sacred, whatever a community considers to be sacred, that again, they're up in arms because you're dealing with the universe, right? The harmony of the universe. And that's beyond the sort of issues of sort of the commercialization and the exploitation and the power differences in terms of who can borrow from other cultures and who cannot. It's really comes down to the basic of are you respecting the sacredness, the sense of the sacredness of our culture? And not trying to exploit it or exploit us in allowing you to engage in what is for us important knowledge. That actually helped clarify things for me.
Yeah, it's a very different way of looking at it. Yeah, I was certainly looking at it from the production consumption angle, more from sort of our perspective, but that really flips it on its head and gives you a much broader appreciation for who you might be harming and why are you causing harm.
Yeah, and so one of my favorite classes that I've taught is this class called Transcultural Aesthetics and Contemporary Design, and it really actually delves into that question of appropriation and misappropriation quite deeply, because the purpose of the class is really like, how do you use culture as a source of inspiration in a ethical way? And so in the class, the students generally pair up with a buddy who might come from a different culture. And that could be like, they could be, American versus Australian, right? Like, it doesn't have to be like exotic cultures, although we've done it, structured it that way again. And so through the process of learning about this person, you go from a process of creating something from low fidelity to high fidelity that has a strong cultural resonance with them. But you have to negotiate this in a respectful way, right? It's all about respectfully engaging with the knowledge that's being shared, the stories that are being shared, the cultural meanings that are being shared. So that, again, that you're creating conditions of sort of harmony and compassion with each other through the process. And in that, again, that there's this strong conversations and strong processes of making that interrogate what's appropriation and misappropriation. And one of the things that made me most happy is one of the students one year in the class had sort of found this motif that they wanted to use, that, and they sort of did the research and found that it actually belongs to the Greek Orthodox Church as a symbol. So they wrote the local Greek Orthodox sort of diocese to sort of say, hey, I found this and I would like to be able to use it in my design. So I want to know if it would be okay. And, you know, are there things that I could or should not be able to use it for? And they got a response back from, you know, like the Greek, the Australian Greek Orthodox Church diocese sort of saying, oh, well, this is used for this and this and this, and I think it's okay if you use it in this particular context. Like, that to me is like, that is the perfect manifestation of the kinds of responsibility that we need to have as anthropologists and designers to just check on a community on whether it's okay or not okay to do that. Just to enter into that dialogue would actually solve 99.9% of the issues that we have around appropriation and misappropriation.
Well, I was just thinking, so real fast, you know, you talk about sort of design being a bridge between cultures, and, you know, using that statement, I wonder how you can make use of design and how you can sort of respectfully borrow, and trying to tie this in to respectful design, how you can respectfully borrow to almost teach, to build that bridge. You know, so requesting access to that motif is a nice example, because then you can turn around, share it with others, and hopefully inform them about where it comes from and maybe its original intention. So how do you see that then merging into the fifth?
So the fifth iteration of respectful design is kind of taking all of, so again, I'm no longer a professor of design anthropology. I'm a dean of the faculty of design, and I'm the first black female dean of a faculty of design anywhere in the world. So I can't talk about design anthropology in the same sort of way, right? Like the seven principles underlie what it is that I do, but like the institution itself is not going to understand themselves as a design anthropology faculty. So respectful design is kind of a way to talk about this, these ethos, I think, at a meta design level, right? Not specific to a discipline, but about what is the way, what are the potential ways of design being in the world, right? And so it came out again of conversations that happened at Swinburne, and I think four particular streams of conversations that were happening. So me coming from like an anthropology perspective, at the time at Swinburne, we had engaged with Dr. Norm Sheehan, who was Aboriginal scholar and educator, and talking about, I think, the importance of respect from Aboriginal culture. It's one of the four main principles of Aboriginal cultural sort of philosophy in terms of respect, know, care, and share. So, and then also at Swinburne, we had Frank Fisher, who is like sort of this amazing guru of sustainability and sustainability seeking. And then Dr. Deidre Barron, my colleague, who come from a really strong sort of feminist education and pedagogy perspective. And so I think that through the conversations of all five of us, this notion of respectful design as an ethos became really important. As I then again moved from Australia to Canada, I wanted to be able to talk about the work that I actually had seen happening at OCAD University, so Ontario College of Art and Design University. Already, they had a really strong ethos in design and humanity, which a lot of that was being led by the work of Dr. Alex Manu. But I wanted to, needed to integrate that Indigenous perspective, because right now in Canada, there's a strong government mandate to decolonize the curriculum, decolonize sort of both primary and secondary education systems, as well as post-secondary universities. And so we needed to be able to tie in that Indigenous perspective to things. And so respectful design in this context of sort of Canada allows me to sort of take the design and humanity aspects that is very closely related to sort of design anthropology in its ethos, but interweave it with Indigenous ways of knowing and Indigenous ways of learning under this notion of respect and the respect that we have for one another, respect we have for other living creatures, the respect we have for nature, and then to talk about that in terms of, again, still emphasizing design, but it's the kind of design that we do is respectful of all things. And that's been really amazing. Like I've been spent the last, I haven't had a full year yet at OCAD University, but I've been doing a couple of keynote presentations around respectful design. When I first came in 2 weeks, I held a workshop on respectful design where we used like a kind of World Cafe model to bring from the bottom up what sort of respectful design meant for each individual in the faculty, what respectful design meant for each of the six departments and five graduate programs that we have, and then what respectful design needed to mean for the faculty in general. And we sort of did these little mini videos of each of those statements. And so we have this beautifully sort of articulated way of talking about respectful design in terms of, again, respecting differences in perspective, respecting nature, respecting everyone and everything, and using our creative methodologies to make manifest in many ways, to make tangible that respect we have for all of the things that exist. And that sort of expresses itself in different ways for different disciplines. So like environmental design, they talk about designing humans back into the environment. For advertising, they talk about it in terms of emphasizing need over want. In graphic design, it's about talking about, you know, recognizing the harm we can do as well as the good that we can do through material art and design, which is our program that brings together textiles and jewelry and ceramics. It's about, again, a deep understanding of the materials that we use and using them in a respectful way to sort of make, right, to make the things that people need in the world.
That's so interesting. Particularly, I mean, in this case, the question of advertising there is really interesting in terms of, you know, prioritizing need over want in this case, because, you know, is that that's not obviously not been the traditional goal of advertising, but that's a wonderful way to think about, you know, how do we sort of project and design for what somebody might want. And this actually harkens back to the notion of the IRS we were talking about before in terms of, right, it's like, how do you be responsive to like a larger need segment rather than saying, here's what you want to have or you should have. But something that we all need to be well. That's cool. I mean, this is a really wonderful thing to think of too, particularly obviously, you know, because there's the U.S. has a very, you know, bad and sad and continual history of sort of exclusion of indigenous peoples and ideas and appropriation from that. And so this is a beautiful idea of thinking about how to sort of instill this in an educational institution. And that's actually, I think, a wonderful point. Maybe we can kind of close out on is that just this is all about education too, which is a beautiful thing. Yeah, and sort of like, you know, this is in so much of what I hear you saying too, is this is about dialogue, right? And so much of this is about entering into dialogue with people as, you know, equal others. And now this is kind of like even Martin Buber's I and thou idea, you know, from old school theology. But just that, you know, we enter into this as two, you know, fully formed or more beings, and that we each have, you know, our own perspectives, backgrounds, ideas, and hopes for the future. And that can, a dialogue is about just putting all those on the table together and saying there's space for all these things, these multiple voices, multiple needs and wants. And then how do we iterate them together that everybody, you know, sort of walks away better?
Which again goes back to the thing, like, again, anthropologists and designers are the optimum facilitators and all of this. Because again, you know, like even in this process, what we're trying to figure out is, again, what are the respecting the differences at the same time articulating what our commonalities are, and how do we recognize and respect that, right? To sort of say that perspective has worth in its own existence beyond how useful it might be to me, right? We always, this is where it's like, I think we need to move away again from like the language around users and usefulness. We need to move a little bit behind, beyond sort of the notion of human-centered design. Like, humans need to be decentered as well. I mean, I don't know if we want to go into sort of cockroach-centered design, but we actually have to recognize that we share this planet with other creatures, but we've made these worlds that exclude them, right? Like, how do we do, we have this program in inclusive design, and I sort of say, you know, what we push for is radical inclusion. Inclusion, just not just the diversity of humans, but the diversity of all of the different forms of living that exist in our universe.
And that's a wonderful point. And it also brings up for me the question of designing not just for humans and the other forms of life today, but what we are about to create next. And so, you know, designing for a world for AI and what that impact is going to be on humans and other forms of life is something I think it seems like we also need to really be thinking about, because there's a potential to really disrupt the world in pretty substantial ways, from disrupting jobs to.
Well, and this is where I think, in terms of our relationship with technology, we really, again, need to think about what our values are. Because one of the things that we sort of say that is our biggest struggle here in the project of respectful design is the way in which design is tied up into what we're calling now the modernist project. And the modernist project that sort of comes out of Europe, particularly sort of turn of the century European desire to one create a society, a utopian society in which like all of the ethnic differences that existed in Europe that led to centuries and centuries of war and conflict, where we sort of say, okay, let's erase all these ethnic differences so that we can be one universal humankind, right? What I think is important to this discussion is this notion of technology being a equalizer in the sense that, again, from a design perspective, is that, okay, if we can manufacture these things, what are these things? If we can manufacture these things more efficiently and effectively, then it's not only the aristocracy who will have nice things, nice houses, nice clothing, nice chairs, nice whatever, but in most cases, they're really focused on sort of the bourgeoisie, the merchant class, but again, pulling down to even the poorest people, that we will be able to have those nice things as well. And technology is what allows us all to have these nice things. But the values are still driven in that modernist project around, in some ways, sort of imitation of the aristocracy. And to the extent to which the aristocracy lived in excess because from a Marxist perspective, they stole the excess capacity of everyone else, right? To the extent to which they live in excess, that sort of democratic notion in some ways of providing everyone is still based on let's provide everyone with the same level of excess that the aristocracy has, which then leads to a lack of sustainability. All this to sort of say, then, how does that relate to AI? That a lot of our, if you think about the uses that AI is wanting to be put into, it's still operating under that same value system of the modernist project, right? It's about how we can provide information more effectively, more efficiently. How do we reduce the labor, the human labor of these processes as a way to, you know, if you were being generous about it, to free them up for more leisure, which again, it is based still on a value ethos of an aristocratic class, right? And what we're finding, I guess, with AI is that it's to the extent to which it is not independent of human creation, we're just building into it the same prejudices, the same inequalities, social inequalities, gender inequalities. We're building into that technology the same sort of things that we need to work on as a human society. So what in some cases has the potential to do is really just accelerate the negative aspects of our society because we're not building it from a different, we haven't changed the value systems under which that technological tool is operating. Brenda Laurel gave a talk at the IXDA conference in New York about AR and VR and all these sort of technologies. And what really inspired me from her talk is that she says, like, you know, we have the technology to do everything. What's actually really important is what are the values that we have around that way in which this technology needs to operate in the world. And she gave this beautiful example of, like, you know, with augmented reality and virtual reality, like one of the challenges we have is that, let's say, children are disconnected from their food systems, right? They think chicken comes in squares or you know, covered already in sort of some kind of batter, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so we actually, from a sustainability perspective, in terms of like, again, our interconnectedness with the natural world, we actually need to bring our young people back to nature, back to an understanding of the processes of growing. And so she talked about this scenario of where we would use the technology, all the technologies that are available now, right, to, you know, have, to help a student plant a school, students plant a school garden, and that the virtual reality or the augmented reality is about providing stories and context around, like, if the student has a question of, like, how do we plant the squash and the beans and the corn in the garden, then sort of a avatar would pop up from augmented reality, and she might be a young Hopi Native American girl, and she'll tell the stories of the three sisters in terms of how Native Americans, bought, used the stalk of the corn, that then they planted the beans that sort of would use the stalk as its way to climb, and then with the squash underneath providing the fertilizer that allows the host system to work, right? And so she says, like, these kind of uses of technology, again, are fine because they're driven around a specific value, again, reconnecting children to the natural food system, that then it makes sure that these technologies will not do harm, right? Because these technologies are a tool, they can, again, what are the experiences that we're seeking to create through these sort of values that, again, these technologies is a form of design? What is it that we're trying to create? And right now, the way in which AI is being used, I don't question the technology, but I question the values that are driving the development of the technology, because it seems in some cases that it's the values are not meant to create relationships of harmony or compassion.
Yeah, certainly. And your three sisters example is really wonderful, you know, and versus something like in the States, the High Tech Act in 2009, the Health Information Technology for Economic and Clinical Health, you know, where economic comes before the word health, clearly sort of articulating the values of the states. And, you know, sure, in purpose, you know, you can argue it makes sense, right? We digitize and presumably everybody will get healthier, but of course it hasn't quite worked out that way.
Right.
And, you know, how that sort of manifests is you have an EHR where you can see, say, your blood work, but you don't have, most people don't have the sort of, you know, the capital, the sort of, they haven't had the experiences to go to university and to, you know, all of those opportunities to even make sense of what those abbreviations and numbers mean.
Right.
And so
right.
It's not translating, but it's saving money for some
person and making money for some other person.
Yeah. Right?
Mm-hmm. Precisely. Well, this has been an absolutely fascinating conversation. I'm actually sorry to even say we should cut it up.
I told you it'd be really hard.
You're done well. We have to come back and do a follow-up then in this case. But Dori, thank you so much. This has been an amazing conversation. It's been enlightening to think through design anthropology, but really in this way that is incredibly grounded. This is one of the things that I'm walking away with, is that even looking at the tool set you developed and drawn from is both clear, but also it's effective. I mean, it seems like it's an empathetic way of, you know, because design says it's framed around, you know, sort of generating empathy. And these seem like really good tool sets and forms of thinking and doing that actually do that. And that generate it. And so that's beautiful. I mean, I want to thank you so much for sharing this, you know, your story with us and this amazing scaffolding.
Well, again, thank you so much for, like, the conversation and the questions and the opportunity to really help share and articulate some of the things that I think are really important to me, but also, again, really important to the students and the partners that I've worked with over the last few years. So it's been good to share. I look forward to talking sometime soon. And again, thank you very much for the opportunity.